Playback on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Dublin Airport's Platinum VIP Terminal. Experience private check-in, suites for relaxation, and then chauffeur-driven to your aircraft.
Good morning. There is no other lead this week other than the great goodbye, after all those hellos.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you are very welcome to Liveline. Anya, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
Jackie Bourne, good afternoon.
How are you?
Bridget, good afternoon. Donna, what's your situation? Grania, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you, Joe? Thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah, okay.
I have two children with cystic fibrosis who have been denied a life-changing drug along with just 33 other children.
Yeah, we go straight to a relative of one of the 48 people who died in the Stardust disaster. When he arrived in Willow Park, did they know this man's history?
Now, I sang at funerals for 40 years, Joe, and I never heard anybody giving a eulogy and using bad language.
Well, have you heard a eulogy that went on for an hour? That's incredible, yeah. Isn't it, Daryl? Now, are you going to hold on to it, Martin? Will you cycle in with it, Martin?
Well, I'm a cyclist myself, so
Boy. Your coat is gone. Your headphones are gone.
Yeah.
It's raining.
Yeah.
You're crying, understandably. You've great spirit. I never beep a cyclist under any circumstances. If it was Elvis himself on a bike, I wouldn't beep some of the scenes in Normal People.
Well, I think that they're focusing a lot on the sex part, when I think what we should be looking at is how well they actually portrayed the consent within the programme.
I have loads of Fibre Friday offers.
And I won't, you know I don't pry. Was it a first date? Yeah, how did that go?
For 27 years, we talked to Joe on Liveline, and we talked about all sorts. Deeply personal stories that lifted the veil on an often hidden Ireland. Stories of institutional abuse and corporal punishment. Stories of the menopause and childbirth. And stories of the people behind the headlines, often much talked about, but rarely talked to. Because you knew that if you picked up the phone, Joe might just take the call. We also had Scams Exposed, Fiverr Friday, Funny Friday and the Christmas Eve specials. As the cliche goes, we laughed, we cried and sometimes we heard stories that changed Irish society. On Morning Ireland yesterday, Anya did the final interview.
In your 27 years on Liveline though, the democracy of Liveline, because if I had a penny for every politician who said to me, that Joe Duffy fella and that Liveline programme, they thought it was the bane of their lives. But I think it was really important. It was a place where people who didn't have big lawyers or lobbyists could go.
I was conscious of that. I've never been in the Dáil Bar. I don't think I like politicians, but I've never been that close. But I understand the power of politicians, and more so, I think one of the, I know people were talking earlier about the closure of the head shops, 2010. I was Christmas 2009. I was walking down Talbot Street late one night, and I saw this queue at a shop at a window, like you'd seen a petrol station, and it was a head shop. And Anya, I hadn't a clue where a head shop was. I hadn't a clue. And I asked people, what are these guys selling? And they were basically drugs they were selling, let's be blunt. And I mentioned on the first day back in January on Liveline, and we discovered within 2 days there was over 100 head shops thriving in Ireland. Thriving. And then people start ringing in about the effects of this.
Yeah.
We didn't know what they were selling. Unregulated, unbelievable, making massive, massive profits. But then come May the 10th at 2 o'clock, Brian Cowan, who was Taoiseach, Mary Harney, in fairness, Minister for Health, and Dermot Ahern, Minister for Justice, the three of them at 2 o'clock on May the 10th, 2010, they raided every single head shop in the country and shut them down at the one time. And that's the power of politics. I know it's the power of people on Liveline bringing it to people's attention.
And there were so many issues that Liveline had championed over the years. And it was to Joe that Susie Long had spoken when she was diagnosed with cancer.
But today when I heard that a very nice man who was in the same, if not worse, condition than me, when he went to his GP, is going to live because he had private health insurance and I'm going to die because I didn't, I had to bite my tongue. I'm happy he's going to live. He deserves to live. But so do I.
What generosity in that. Saying that about that other man. I'm happy that he's going to live, but I'm going to die because of the two-tier health system. tears from a stone, Susie, Rosie, as we called her, she wanted to be called in those days. It's just, that's the voice, it's the voices on Liveline. The less I talk, the better.
Oh, not sure about that at all. But at 1:45 yesterday, it was time for Joe to sit back a little, only a little, mind you, and enjoy the final show. It was a farewell extravaganza kicked off by the Camembert Quartet and this wee ditty.
Thank you for being a friend. Travel down the road and back again. Your heart is true, you're a pal and a confidant. You listen to us complain, laughed and cried with us all the way. Well, now your hat is on, won't you stand up and take a bow?
And all of the friends of the show, Funny Friday regulars and more, were there. Push Shields.
Myself and Joe go back a long way. He hasn't changed at all. Spiritually, there's no one like him. He can be generous, gregarious, gloriously full of good grace, or a gift of the gab, gill, or gavitas, and just, he'd never genuflected the gentry or trying second guess the groff or growing into well ground the garner. He's a genuine genius, a genial coucher who has no group of grieving, grad or grooving rubble. And the goals who glow carries gold. He's a global gladiator, groomed, gleaming and glistening. He's beautiful. I love him and he knows it.
What about that, Brush Shield?
And then queen of the one-liner, June Rogers.
My sister was caught shoplifting in a sweet shop. She got away with it, though. She had a couple of Twix up her sleeve. But we were poor. One day, I saw me ma counting out the copper coins on the kitchen table when she started shouting and crying for no reason. I thought to myself, she's going through the change.
Ah, yes, and that brings us to the game changer that was Liveline and the menopause. In May 2021, they got an email into the programme.
And it was about one woman's terrible menopausal journey. And she finished the email and she said, the purpose of this email, Joe, is for you to please consider this topic on your show. Give the women of Ireland a voice to be heard, bust the taboos and really open up the subject. You certainly opened up the subject of menopause,
well, Sally
would
Ann,
you all agree?
That, well, the letter was an incredible letter.
And Sally Ann is here,
letter.
Joe.
I know Sally Ann, and the producers, when they got the letter, Sally Ann, they ran into me at 20 to 3. So fair play to the producers. They said to me, you have to read this. And it was a powerful piece. A powerful, powerful piece. Great to see you. Great to see you.
What do you remember about that, Sally Ann?
I remember that I was shocked that somebody listened to me. Joe listened to me and no one else had. So on behalf of the women of Ireland, I had said in the email, can you give these women a voice? And you did. And you've changed the landscape for women in the country. Thank you.
You have, Sally. And all the great campaign.
And make no mistake, Liveline was there for some of the biggest moments in our country's history. The booms, the busts, the would-be bank runs. But also the international events that few of us will ever forget. On Morning Ireland, arts and media correspondent Evelyn O'Rourke, who had worked on Liveline, recalled 9/11.
The first plane flew into the tower at 8:46 a.m. And I remember being out in the car, and we all talked about it afterwards, that suddenly we heard voices like Conor Cleary from the Irish Times, Neil O'Dowd on, just describing in real time what was happening. And it was just extraordinary radio. My memories, I think he stayed on air that day, but just, it was his voice, it was his programme, and he got it. And of course, being Joe, as soon as he could, he hopped on a plane. I was over in New York with him for that, and it was extraordinary. He spent the week pounding the streets in New York. He, of course, has always had such a loyalty and affection to fire brigades. He's really interested in that world. He was down at the firehouses, but bringing those stories, he was at the helm of that. You know, he just wanted to be always where the story was, where the people were. And those instincts always served him really, really well.
Yeah, that really strong news judgment that Joe Duffy has. He has something else as well, a very strong BS detector.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, one of the ones that's on my list is the scams. I mean, he absolutely just revelled when he could put somebody on the hook who was, he felt, defrauding or in any way hoodwinking his listeners. And I think it was that laser beam connection with his listeners. You know, that's what really stands out. You heard it in the Vox Pop there as well. He was communicating directly with his listeners and he got that conversation. He was from Ballyfermot. And let's be honest, at the time in RT, that his accent stood out. He will talk about that. He had to battle. He was never handed anything. He had to keep working really hard to keep proving that his place was there, that he had that unique relationship with the microphone, with the studio, but with the listeners outside. Because often when you're in the studio, you can forget about the outside world. You're very connected with what's happening around you. He never lost that focus with the people who were ringing in, and he knew it was their show. And you'd say to him about campaigning, he said, no, I'm not, you know, this isn't a campaign or whatever. This is what the people want to talk about. But what I found fascinating about him was somebody would be on, they'd be telling a story. He would pick up on some tiny detail and drill into it, and that would become the story. So it was the producer in him, I think, always enhanced broadcasting.
But it wasn't all serious. Let's just take a moment to remember the glory that was the Normal People programme. And also a particular favourite in a sweltering summer, this.
Bae. They're listening in Princeton in New Jersey, USA. Most memorable moment was the ups and downs of the mountain goat. Does anyone remember that? Stuck
yes.
in the cage.
The puck.
Puck fair. Nothing was ever too trivial or too petty to warrant the Liveline perspective of human interest. Thank you, Andy Walker. Enjoy your breakfast in Princeton.
But we cannot tell a lie because, yes, we did have Funny Friday, but Monday to Thursday, well, it was not always laugh-a-minute. Here is Joseph S. O'Connor. The S is vital, by the way.
I have a confession. I love my depression and nobody knew it like Joe. He could sense my despair as he took to the air. He was thinking of me with each show. Not for him the good news, he's the king of the blues, of the morbid, the shock and the bleak. What a national treasure, who beyond any measure could wreck your head week after week. Oh, how did he know? Sure, no one here knew it. Such a talent for finding a story, but it didn't get on unless all hope was gone or it had a true sense of the gory. Go on, tell us, he'd say, in a nonchalant way, as the caller would just spill their guts. But our Joe made it clear, if they dared adding cheer, they'd be cut, no ifs and no buts. Wash your hands.
Oh, and the slagging did not end there.
Okay, good afternoon to you. 515, wash your hands. Yeah, good to see you there, me scream. Wonderful, wonderful tributes coming in from friends and Joe foes. Michael O'Leary, go ahead.
Yeah, well, this is the happiest day of my life.
Don't say that, Michael.
Finally, you and all the whingers are going back to where you came from, which I think is Krusty Clontarf.
Be nice now, be nice.
Well, you wouldn't have me on if I was, because you love it. Joe Scruffy filling the airwaves from Pravda and Montrose with your lefty liberal bias, pandering to all those layabout iceberg shaggers trying to destroy Ryanair.
I miss you too, you Mullingar Minger. Yeah. Who's on line four? Go ahead.
It's a very sad day, Katie.
No, it's Joe still here, but Bertie, go on.
Stop all the clocks. Cut off the telephones.
Yeah. I'm not dead.
I just want to say my thoughts and stares are with his family. We'll never see his bike again, and may he rest in bits.
Anyway, we're moving on from that. Who's on line five? David McSavage. No, thank you very much. I'd rather be sung out by the Wolf Tones than go through a McSavaging again.
Arise, Sir Joe.
Bono, good afternoon to you. Mm-hmm. And thank you. But I'm from Ballyare, more Nightlink than Knighthood.
Ireland, my Ireland will miss you, Joe. Can I just say,
go on, yeah.
Up the Joe. I say, up the Joe.
They're all at it now.
Up the Joe.
Yeah! Bye.
Ooh, less of a thank you for your service than a straight up roast. But only a fool would underestimate the power of Liveline. Because when a topic made the Liveline, well, everyone paid attention. Yesterday, Taoiseach Micheál Martin rang in to pay tribute to the journalism work done by Joe and the programme team.
You were and are the voice of the people. You were authentic. Yeah. You gave the people a platform. Yeah. And I think you never left your roots. Your working class background stood to you. Yeah. The values that your parents and family gave to you, I think, were the reason why you were unique. You had a unique capacity to mediate between the people and authority and allow them to tell their stories. And on a personal level, we've known you, going back to my student days,
yeah.
where you taught me a few things when I was a student activist.
Yeah, you forgot them quick enough now.
I find memories of the guy from Ballyfermot but coming down to the UCC Students Union, telling us how to do things. Yeah. But I learned a lot from you. And later on in life in West Cork and elsewhere, we our paths crossed. Yeah. And what people, I think people do know, but your personal acts of kindness have always been, you know, quite extraordinary and something that has touched our family quite a lot.
Taoiseach Micheál Martin. And as yesterday's programme finished, Shea Byrne read a tribute from President Michael D. Higgins. This was how it opened.
Dear Joe, as you prepare to take your leave from the National Airwaves, after so many years of dedicated service, may I, Maruchtaran the Héireann, extend to you the warmest of thanks on behalf of the Irish people for your remarkable contribution to public life, one that you have shaped with empathy, insight, and an unwavering commitment to the voices of ordinary people. Thraisliam Lat. From your early days as a student of social work at Trinity College through to your time as president of Trinity College Students' Union in 1979, and later as president of the Union of Students in Ireland, you have demonstrated a lifelong commitment to justice, equality, and public service. Through your work, you have borne witness to the struggles and triumphs of the Irish people, often giving voice to those on the margins and creating a space in which silence could be broken and solidarity expressed, reminding us that behind every headline is a human story, reminding us too that our society is strengthened by the lived experiences of its people.
From Joe Duffy's final Lifeline programme yesterday. Now we're almost at a finish, and as Joe was at pains to point out, Lifeline, it will be back, you know, on Monday, fret not, listener. But after 27 years at the helm, it was a big day. And all week long, callers had phoned in to Lifeline to thank Joe for the chats and the memories. So it is with a caller we will finish.
I know Lifeline will carry on, but
course,
I think that Lifeline without Joe Duffy will be like Vegas without Elvis, be like the Vatican without the Holy Father, the Late Late without Gabo, Dublin without Bewleys, country music without Daniel O'Donnell, and Kerry football without Mick O'Connor. God bless you, Joe.
God bless you.
I look forward to the next thing that you do, Joe.
Yeah, okay. And the next thing is
God bless you.
Tomorrow's programme. Go to Mina Margaret Marklean, Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Back in a bit. Welcome back. Is it really a sausage if no piggies are involved? In short,
when is a sausage not a sausage?
Ah yes, in a mixed up crazy world, finally, a spat we can all get behind. And this prompted by an EU Commission proposal that would ban plant-based products from using terms such as burger and sausage. Get your own, none of your vegan sausage here. So says Dennis Drennan, president of the ICMSA.
What harm does it do the pork sausage if something else is called a vegan sausage?
Well, I think it's the word sausage. Like, if you want to call it something, like, the understanding with 99% of people would be that a sausage is a sausage. I mean, if you look up the dictionary, it says it's a, you know, minced pork mixed with spices and presented in a tube-like structure that was originally the intestine of the pig. Now it's obviously more, there's different skins being used because of the volume of sausages that are being sold. But it should be just left there. I mean, this is.
So if you use the word sausage, it's got to be meat. But going for a sausage for all seasons argument, public policy advisor Oisin Coughlan.
I think I'm genuinely puzzled as to what Dennis or the industry or the MEPs are afraid of, that people be accidentally have a non-meat sausage and then like it so much they won't go back. Like, I don't think there's any threat here. Like, I love sausages, and I cook bangers and mash for my kids, but one of my family is a vegetarian, and we get Linda McCartney or some other vegetarian sausage. It says vegetarian.
That's not a sausage. No, Oisin, that's not a sausage, apparently. That's something else.
You or I mightn't like it as much as a pork sausage, but that's how people call it, and language evolves. In fact, I went to my supermarket in advance of this item. All the pork sausages actually say pork sausage. And then there'll be, you know, somewhere else in the fridge or freezer, there's Linda McCartney vegetarian sausage. So I just think it's a strange move to try to police that language.
I suppose you've got the big vegan, and they are big, huge companies. They're piggybacking on generations of, yeah, I know, I like that, on generations of marketing and hard work done by meat producers. And as Dennis says, if their products are so good, we'll let them call them something else and see how they fare.
But I mean, I just don't think the language evolves. People are going, this isn't going to work, no matter what the EU does. It's just the way that it's going. We have sausage dogs, you know.
Well, let's not eat those cuties. But as in all good arguments, won't anyone think of the children?
If you would give a child a sausage that's not a sausage, and they have an undesirable reaction to it, that they don't like sausages, well then, you know, you've contaminated the child's image of what a sausage should be. And this is where the problem is. If I go skiing in wherever it is, Austria or Italy, and I have goulash, and I discover that I don't like goulash because it doesn't contain meat, well then I have a bad experience, and it puts me off eating goulash for the future.
Most people are sensible, though, Dennis, aren't they? I mean, they'll know it's the vegan sausage they didn't like, or the pork sausage that they didn't like, not the sausage.
Well, who knows? We're in a very influential time for young people and for children, and I mean, one bad experience can put somebody off something for life.
And you wouldn't want that. Well, whatever you are eating this morning, stick a fork in it and enjoy. And now, to the banjo. Of course, you can't have the banjo without this.
It put banjo on the map.
Oh, it certainly did, for better or worse. That's Enda Scal from We Banjo 3. He spoke to Oliver.
Deliverance must be the 70s or early 80s.
Yeah, 1972, I believe.
Oh,
yeah.
That's far back as that, more than 50 years. And this is where the city slickers are kind of meeting the rural. And it's a kind of a happy scene, but there's a foreshadowing of the dark themes in the film that are to come.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I don't know if you can do that with one, because you don't have the duelling aspect here.
Yeah, and so this is interesting as well, because this is very much where Irish banjo sits at home and the bluegrass banjo takes off. So everybody knows. Right?
Yeah.
And we can all play that, because that's dead easy, right?
Is it? Okay. Take your word for it.
Right. Now, this is every Irish banjo player's worst nightmare is like, hey, do you know Deliverance? Right? And it's like, I know that bit, right? Because that bit's easy. And then after that, it goes into the, which is like crazy fast. Yeah. And that's the three finger picking style that was popularized in Kentucky in 1932. Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys started bluegrass music essentially with this one band. So that's a completely different pick and pattern, so everybody can do the and it's amazing, like it's the 1970s. If you do that anywhere, basically people go, oh, Deliverance. That's just two chords. And then we're lost, right? Absolutely iconic piece of music.
It is, yeah, it is, yeah. But it's a nightmare. I'm sure in a banjo shop it's even worse.
It's the Stairway to Heaven of banjos.
On Thursday with Brenton Courtney in for the Darcy, Don Lissom, a.k.a. Dino Don.
Where did your love for dinosaurs come from?
Yeah. I was a three-year-old like every other three-year-old, or most of them.
Yeah.
Went to the museum, met T-Rex and fell in love.
And that was that.
That was that. And it lasts for a while, you know, until you're about 8 years old.
Yeah.
And then I have to admit, I forgot about them. And I was a reporter.
Were you?
Yeah, for a while. And the newspaper in those days actually had money. And they said, why don't you go do a story about these crazy dinosaur scientists that we see on TV? And I said, sure. And I really never came back after that. Every single guy who does this, I don't know how to compare it. It's like people who live in Alaska. There's a reason they're there, because they're all crazy. So who else would live there? In the case of dinosaur scientists, they just love this stuff and they have a gift for seeing the world as it once was. And that's what got me the second time around to fall in love. It wasn't just the dinosaurs, but this quest, you know, that you're looking for something nobody's ever seen.
Oh, wow.
In a landscape that's
romantic.
Usually a desert, but you're envisioning this world that, you know, doesn't exist anymore. And some people can do that. And I just wanted to be able to try and do that.
And he has. He's written over 40 books on the natural world and also become an expert in creating robotic replicas of dinosaurs. But this, born out of a deep dislike of the old school models.
I hated them. I always thought these are inaccurate. They're not full size. And so I went, and I'm an old guy, so I always wanted to go to this one great dinosaur quarry in China where it looks like the skeletons just sort of fell over. They're that well preserved.
Wow.
I went there, saw the wonderful skeletons, and they said, you know, you're in the town where the robots are made. Almost all the robots in the world want to go see them. And I said, no, because they're, how would you say, shite? And they said, well, just go see. And I went. And they were made by little old ladies with X-Acto knives, carving couch cushions, and making terrible dinosaurs. But I realized there's no mold. So it's not like they're all being made the same. They just, no one gave them the information. So I thought, I'll bring a scientist, I'll bring some artists, we'll bring some drawings.
Wow.
And so then we started making full-size accurate dinosaurs, and believe it or not, there was a niche for this. And to me, just what you're saying, there's no other way, even in the movies, to see just how enormous these things are. The biggest dinosaur, 50 times the size of an elephant.
Kind of hard to get your head around. But Dino Dom has had one hell of a career. He's also worked as an advisor to Steven Spielberg on Jurassic Park. Again, born out of his niggling attention to detail.
I was walking around on the set, helping out there as well, and trying to correct people and being told to shut up. But at the end, I said, look, you made a movie in which the dinosaurs are dead wrong. In
fact, did you say that?
Yeah. Love that. Said throughout. But because I'm addicted to the facts, you know, as a reporter, you always are. And, you know, I'm talking to the third assistant director. And at one point, I don't know if people have seen the movie, everybody has.
Yeah.
But Laura Dern is looking out in the desert at this screen where a guy is looking under the ground, supposedly looking at a dinosaur. And he says it's all curved up. It must have taken thousands of years. I said, no, that's what happens when you die, but you don't have a tail. You get rigor mortis and you look like that. It takes about a couple hours. So I see the woman where I'm in the back of 100 people. It was like one of these commercials, you know. They walk up to Spielberg and whisper, you know, some guy says, this is all wrong. So he said, come up here and rewrite the line. So I actually got to talking to him because I was one of the few people who didn't want anything from him, other than maybe they could give me some money for research. And so at the end of the movie, I said, give me all the sets and props. I'll make an exhibit about what's wrong with this movie. And he said yes.
That's amazing.
He said yes, and then Universal was afraid of him. So they said yes and got the tax break. And we raised $3 million for research and toured for years an exhibit in Europe and America about what's wrong with that movie.
Good on you. And finally, this from Brendan, and a really good answer from Don.
Culturally, children are obsessed with dinosaurs. What is that, do you think?
It's a genetic defect. It corrects itself when they get to be 8 or 9, but thank God they have it. Otherwise, I'd be out of business. No, I think, if you think about it hard, it's several obsessions that dinosaurs occupy. When you're 3, it's like Barney. It's like this fantasy creature that's somewhere between real and not real.
Okay.
You get a little older and they're monsters, but they're not scary because you know they're dead. So they're not under the bed. And then you can say Triceratops and your parents are like, whoa, my kid must be smart.
Okay.
So you get a lot of feedback. And then you're collecting things like Pokemon, but you're collecting all the different dinosaurs. And then you're digging them up.
Dino Don with Brendan. And while digging up the dinosaurs in the back garden here might not be doable, you could kneel down, or better still, lie down and get up close to our insects. On Mooney Goes Wild, Lisa Clancy. She's just published Insect Portraits, and she took Aine and Ilona through some of her favourite bugs. And when it comes to mating, well, think of it like a good old country song. You've got to expect some lying and some cheating.
Dishonest sexual signalling in insects really grabbed me. This idea of males and females of a species falsely advertising their quality to each other. I don't know if you read the one about the daggerfly and how during courtship, the male will present a nuptial gift to a female, which is typically a dead insect. And this is an ancient behaviour that evolved at a time before flowering plants. And then when flowering plants came along, suddenly there was this cheap energy source, this nectar. And as the males started to rely more and more on this energy source, they've sort of partially lost the ability to hunt. So now when they're procuring these nuptial gifts, they're getting injured, they're dying at these very high rates. And they've devise what I think are these comical adaptations to cope with this. So they'll cheat. There's reports of them like fashioning bits of willow seed into kind of a spear shape and presenting it to a female as if it's a gift. And before she's realised what's going on, you know, he's mated with her. They'll steal. If they see another male flying past with a dead insect, they'll just try and hijack it off them. And my personal favourite one, they'll reuse gifts. So they'll, if they manage to get an insect and kill one, they'll present it to the female. She'll suck it dry while he's mating with her, and then he'll take it back and he'll give it to another female. And that sort of stuff just, when I was reading it, it just really, really tickled me. But it's proper adaptation. So I read about certain species that have even evolved to have these projections on their legs that like enhance the appearance of these gifts to kind of further deceive the females.
Bad boys, bad boys. But don't worry, it's equal opportunities when it comes to the deception.
In certain populations, there's far more females to males. And that has led to something rarely seen in nature, which is choosy males and competing females. And so the females have these adaptations to cope with this skewed sex ratios. So one report was females who will suck loads of air into her abdomen so it looks like she's full of mature eggs. So she gets a free meal. Well, hopefully it's not a fake gift. She gets a free meal and he thinks he's mated, but really he's only mated with hot air.
Oh, that's a world of dirty tricks. Mating and dating as heard on Mooney Goes Wild. Back in a bit. Welcome back. With Oliver, columnist and writer Sophie White. She was the visiting critic and up for a bit of belly dancing.
You get a belt, like a jangly belt, that you put around your hips.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And like even just meeting that, I was like, I don't know, should I put it, like, where do I put this? Like, do I put it up above the shelf of the C-section's car? Do I put it like in the C-section's car's mouth, gagging the C-section, or down on the hips? I faffed around with that for a bit. And then the music got going and I did kind of lose the sort of self-consciousness, like really quickly.
Did
I
you?
Was quite
impressed. Now, you're now a human tambourine. That's what I'm kind of
exactly.
She quite enjoyed it. But towards the end of the interview, she talked about her alcoholism. She's now 7 years sober, but it was her fifth year that was the hardest.
It is famously said recovery is not linear. And so, yeah, year five was hard. I think obviously everyone's triggers are really different. Like I find mine were like, you know, any kind of uncomfortable feeling, like I couldn't cope with it without just like, you know, burying it, like, and, you know, and drowning it in alcohol. And, you know, so year five, it happened to be just kind of a stressful year. You know, I had a lot of worry about my family stuff and things like that. And I think it was the closest I'd come since I first got sober. It was the closest I came to just caving and reaching the kind of screw it edge where, you know, and I actually like I actually bought a bottle of vodka and went so far as to buy it.
Oh, my God.
And it's mad. I kind of feel like there's a section of maybe people listening who will understand this. But like I knew that this was. It's pure dangerous for addicts to like have, you know, their substance.
How
like
did you get through that moment?
Well, I mean,
you obviously leave the premises with a bottle of vodka.
I the thing is as well, like all the logic in my head was like, just call your sponsor, mm-hmm. call any friends in the program, like do all the things. But at that moment, like it was crazy how actually rational it was. I was like, I don't want to be told not to do this. I need this. And, you know, like I don't want to swear, but, you know, I literally just was like, screw all of this. This is just what I need to get through this right now.
And she talked about the nature of her compulsion to drink. And the oblivion it might bring.
It's such a lonely, isolating thing. Whenever I have that kind of moment, it's never about like enjoying a few G&Ts in the garden of a summer. The plan that presents in my head is literally just go and buy the alcohol I need and like check into a hotel and just be alone and kind of get it done, get what I need done.
What
and like
is,
it's such a drive
what
and
a
it's
description
so destructive.
Of pain that you portrayed.
In the end, she decided not to drink.
I was with my kids. That's the other, like, such disturbing thing. Like, addiction will, can often, like, override, like, every other instinct for love, self-preservation, you know. I returned it and, yeah, I stepped back from the precipice. And I think that was the worst, in a way, of many years. And yeah, it's obviously, it's really, you know, I always feel very like, this feels radioactive to say out loud, you know, particularly when it comes to like, you know, being a mother. And I have received like so much judgment over the years in writing about this and writing about it in the context of being a mother. But I kind of have to, I feel it's more important to just say these things in case there's some other mother who like loves her kids more than herself, more than the world, you know, and, but is in the grips of something that really, really is like a possession.
A remarkably honest interview. Sophie White with Oliver. This week, we had the summer solstice, and you just know that Lyric is going to do something beautiful to mark it. Here's Ambient Orbit from the Berry Peninsula. So take a moment, sit back, and breathe as our Earth whirls. Radio was made for. If you're heading to the cinema this weekend, the big release, F1. Brad Pitt, yes, but also our own Kerry Condon. But is it worth the ticket? Take it away, arena reviewers John Maguire and Dee Malumbi.
John, it's as cheesy as a French supermarket. It really is. But that's not the point. Yeah, the story is not the point. The plot is not the point. None of that matters a damn. You're in the car.
Yeah.
The camera's in the car. Brad Pitt is in the car. You're racing around real circuits. They went around the real F1 circuit, globe-trotting
at the same time as the
real races were going on. You're immersed in that. If the dialogue is a bit cheesy, if the plot is a bit rudimentary, if we can predict every turn in every chicane that the story takes, then that's it.
That's fine. That's
because
fine.
It's for a global audience.
Think that's a thumbs up, Dee.
I do have to give this film a lot of credit for its technical accomplishments. It's like adrenaline pumping. You've got the sound, you've got the editing, you've got the speed, you've got the action. It's kind of this high stakes gambling style of racing. And at one point, in a very on the nose metaphor, you actually have like Sonny and Noah playing poker with each other. I did, though, find that I couldn't like totally forgive its cheesiness. I did find it quite predictable as a movie. And it's very long. It's nearly 3 hours.
Yeah, it's very long. Yeah, it's very
3 hours and predictable. Yeah. Yeah, well, an F1 race is 3 hours.
Alrighty then, stars, people.
Three for me. I mean, this does for Top Gun what Top Gun did for fighter jets, and it transforms them into these machines that zip through the screen in a noise of thunderous sparks, and it's very exciting to watch. But you can't forgive its cheesiness, really. It is quite basic and rudimentary.
I think we've got that it's cheesy at this point.
But good crack, I would recommend it.
Yeah, 3 stars from me as well. It's popcorn movie stuff, you know, it's a bit of fun. But yeah, it's a shame it's just that bit too long.
She's
wandered out of
popcorn,
the car.
Clearly, yes. Okay.
Yes, but no, but yes. Meanwhile, on the news at one, a little bit of grudge holding. Here's the background. Keith Andrews was tipped to be appointed manager of Brentford. Former Ireland manager Martin O'Neill. Well, bygones, not likely. We let Greg Allen take it from here.
O'Neill was often criticised by Andrews when the former Northern Ireland international player was manager of the Republic of Ireland. And speaking on Talksport Radio in Britain, O'Neill said he hopes Keith Andrews is appointed manager of Brentford because then he will realise what management is all about.
Well, why not? I must admit, why not? He has been their set-piece coach. The irony of that there was the fact that when I was the manager of the Republic of Ireland, he was a particularly vitriolic critic of mine at the time. And really was death against me using set pieces to try and win games. And the irony, he becomes the set piece coach of Brentford. Now, really good luck to him. Brentford have decided that if that's the case, that he should get it. I hope he does get it, because then he'll realise what management is all about. You know, and it's just not as easy just to be sitting in a pundit's chair and just sitting criticising someone who had, well, in all honesty, I know a much better career than he had. You know, he was dealing at the bottom end of it while I was winning the European Cup.
Hard to keep a straight face doing a bulletin.
Let it go, son, let it go.
Martin O'Neill there in full flow. QPR have appointed...
Ooh, and also in the news this week, when POTUS does potty mouth, cover your ears, children. We'll let Joe do the honours.
This is not some profanity by some rock star in the midst of a breakdown. This is the President of the United States of America in the last hour.
Yeah, we basically have two countries that have been fighting so long and so hard that they don't know what the f*** they're doing. Do you understand that?
Did you get that?
We most certainly did, in all its glorious technicolor. Well, joining Cormac and Sarah, Fergal Murphy, linguistics lecturer in UCD.
Is it the most effective way, the only way maybe sometimes to get your message across, or a failure of creativity?
Okay, well, normally, on a normal day, I would say that yes, using language like that is perfectly acceptable. It has an emotional effect on the audience and may express your emotional content. But I'll have to kind of go against myself and say there's a time and a place for bad language. And a president, the leader of the free world, addressing reporters is not the time or place. Even if you spell it P-H-U-Q-U-E, it's still not a word for that situation.
Okay, lecturer in linguistics at UCD. Where is the time and place for cursing then?
Well, not on this radio program, so you're okay.
Well, I'll let you if you want to.
I was able to do it talking to your researcher, but I can't do it now.
Why? What's the difference?
Well, the point is that...
Why aren't you authentic, Fergal? I mean, here's the point. What I want here is what I want is authenticity. Like, and people want that as well. And if that's how you are off air, why aren't you like that on air?
Because on air is it's a public broadcast, and broadcast is the key word there, not public. So when I'm having a conversation with you, our emotional content is very visible and is rooted in the situation. But if someone turns on the radio and someone is screaming and shouting and swearing,
yeah,
I mean, even if they're not using bad language, if someone is intemperate, there's no context for the person to sort of process that. So it comes across as very aggressive.
So absolutely no way. But then we had this text, I think you'll find.
At the risk of being pedantic, may I point out that using the F word and other coarse expressions is not actually cursing. Cursing involves asking a higher power to bring misfortune upon another person. The F word and other bad language is just that, bad language. Is that right, Fergal?
Okay. No. Cursing.
And not only that, pedantic, I see you, and I raise you.
The pedant is right, pedantically, but okay. Cursing, as the term is used, generally refers to several uses of offensive speech. Technically speaking, cursing is wishing harm on a person, as the person says, but the term cursing is used comprehensively to include categories such as swearing, obscenity, profanity, blasphemy, name-calling, insulting, verbal aggression, taboo speech, ethnic slurs, vulgarity, slang, and
all right.
Scatology.
Oh, God, Fergal,
so
thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, there you go.
And that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week. And if you're watching Glastonbury, or better still, you're there, you might just see a little bit of CMAT.